This is episode 9.5 of the Living Reminders with Mary and Blake.
2% doesn't sound like much. But 2% of the entire planet, of every person on it, that's more than the world's 10 largest cities combined. It's 140 million people. And like that, they were gone.
All the way from Providence, Rhode Island, welcome to The Living Reminders. It's a podcast dedicated to the show The Leftovers on HBO. We're still here, and so are you. So let's talk to Kath Lingenfelter. Suddenly I'm hidden. It's the darkness of the dawn. And your friends are gone. I'm your host, Mary Larson.
My name is Blake. And I'm glad I'm not a shiny vampire.
Yeah, that would be pretty awkward for us.
Yeah, I'd have to grow out in the sun and, you know, be like all like diamonds and stuff. That would just, you'd just be a little awkward.
Yeah,
people would stare at me.
They would. They already do, but in a good way.
It's because I'm so amazingly attractive.
That's right.
I know. Just if only all of you could see me. I'm just as attractive as my voice. That's correct.
I don't know if that's a good or bad thing. Anyway, enough about Blake. We have quite an awesome episode for you.
We are actually speaking to Kath Lingenfelter. Now, if you don't know who she is, you should by now, actually. But if you don't, she is a writer on The Leftovers. And we're going to get into what she has written. But she has written episode 2, the last episode, Guest. And then she also was writing the next episode coming up, number 9, The Garveys at Their Best. So having her on is actually a real treat, not only for us, but for you guys. We actually get a little chance to get behind the scenes and speak to the people that actually write these shows, especially the episode Guest, which is, you know, widely considered the best episode so far of The Leftovers. We get into a little bit of a discussion on which one was the best one in the interview, but I think you'll get the idea when she pops on.
Well, I think you just whet everyone's appetites.
So let's
get into our interview with Kath Lingenfelter. Joining us now is Kath Lingenfelter. She's a writer for The Leftovers. She actually wrote episode 2, which was Penguin 1, Us 0. My favorite title, just so you know, out of all of the episodes. And she's also written the next episode, which is titled Garveys at Their Best. Now, Kath has also written for Pushing Daisies. Kath, that was one of my favorite shows of all time. Like, most... awesome.
Yay.
Ever. House MD, Caprica, and Deception. And we are just so delighted to have you here chatting with us on The Living Reminders.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's start off. You're an extremely accomplished writer. So we want to know how you got the job with The Leftovers. Did Damon Lindelof and Tom Perata handpick you on their writing staff? How did this all happen?
No, not at all. This is a highly coveted job, and as far as I knew, they already had the people that they wanted, and I spent the summer in Europe traveling because I was going to spend the fall working on my own project. And so I went traveling to inspire myself and clear my head and kind of ran around with my two brothers and met up with some friends. And when I got back, fully with the intention to work on my own stuff, my agents called and said they are looking for somebody on The Leftovers. And I read the material and thought it was spectacular and, of course, knew who Tom Perata was. But I simply went to the meeting to meet Damon Lindelof. I did not go with the intention of getting the job at all. And in fact, cried. During my interview with Damon, it was for me, I felt like it was a total disaster. I got very emotional talking about the material and why it resonated with me, and it was a mess. And so I walked out, and I was like, "Well, not only am I not getting the job, I just humiliated myself in front of Damon Lindelof. That was awesome." And I think it was the next day or the day after, my agents called and said I got the job. And so I said, forget my own project, putting that on the shelf, and I'm going to go work on the show because there's, you know, the ambition of it wasn't like anything else I had been a part of. So I was really excited.
Kath, can you tell us what got you all emotional, or is that something that has yet to play out?
It was about I was talking about my father who I lost 5 years ago, and the amount of anger that I carry because of it, when he passed, the feeling was, well, this changes everything and life will never be the same and I am going to be changed. But with time, things actually, with alarming speed, things went back to the way that they were. And the world kept spinning and people went back to their lives and nothing changed. And even worse, I didn't change. And it made me very angry. I was angry at the world and angry at myself and still had a lot of things to resolve about the loss of my father. And Damon later said that it was because I wore my crazy on my sleeve that he hired me, that anger was something that he thought was part of the essence of the show, of what it was like to live in a post-departure world.
That actually plays as a perfect segue into our next question. In addition to Penguin One, Us Zero, and the next episode, maybe I shouldn't spoil that, but the next episode that is coming out that you had written, you wrote the episode Guest, which featured Nora in her anger and her identity, and it was an absolute triumph. It was my favorite episode up until the one that just aired yesterday. That was a phenomenal episode, too.
It's
very close. It's like one and one A. You know?
I'm team guest. Don't worry, Kath. I'm still team guest.
All right. I like you the best, Mary.
Oh my God, that's just mean. Could you tell me, what was the main goal behind Guest? What were you trying to get at?
When we knew that we were going to do another point of view episode, and when we discussed who that would be and the name Nora came up, it terrified us because we thought, is there enough story there that we can build an entire episode around Nora? And we knew how Nora was going to play into Kevin's life and what she meant for the rest of the season, and that she was a pivotal player, just like Matt Jameson is. And so because of how important she is, and also because the thought of building a story around her terrified us, that's why we did it. Damon loves to find the biggest challenge and take that on. He doesn't want to do the easy story. He doesn't want to break the story that, like, just falls into piece, you know, falls right in line and it's an obvious story. He really wants to challenge himself and the writing staff. So, and Nora is just an incredibly provocative character, and to imagine what happened to her, it seems impossible to imagine what it would be like to be Nora. And so that was exciting to us, to try to tap into that voice. And just personally, I identified with her greatly because, unfortunately, right when we started working on the show, my mother was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer, and so it's a terminal diagnosis, and so I was in this suspended emotional state of knowing I was going to lose my mother, but she's still here, so I don't know whether to start grieving for her or pretend that it's not going to happen. And it was a very chaotic emotional time for me. And I felt that I understood a lot of the space that Nora lived in. And so I just, you know, I wasn't going to let anybody else write that episode. And so what we wanted to, what we wanted to achieve with the episode was is just to think about grief and also a big part of our show, which, you know, it would probably be surprising for people to hear this, but a big part of our show is about hope, is about when are you able to find your way through the grief and be able to even even consider the idea of hope, of there is another side of this, but that you can get through this and not completely be, you know, have your grief resolved, but that you could consider the possibility of moving forward, of moving beyond this grief. So I think we were, you know, that's one of the bigger things that for me we were exploring in the show, and Nora was certainly was the most heightened example of, can this person who has lost everything, could it be possible for her to consider getting to the other side of her grief, or even trying, wanting to?
With that in mind, then, what was some of the struggles that you and Damon had in breaking the story for Guest?
You know, there's Damon and I have two different styles in the room, and for me, I can be fairly deliberate when I break story, that I'm want to understand what is the theme that we're exploring, or what is the bigger idea that we're exploring, and how do we solve for X? How do we set up the pins and knock them down so that, you know, the math all lines up with the story? That's sort of my default setting when I'm breaking story, and then hopefully it becomes a little more nuanced as we go on. And Damon, much like another boss that I had, Brian Fuller, who is amazing, they really enjoy improvising with story. They enjoy letting the story lead them. It's almost like they're playing jazz. And so there was a conflict there where, you know, I'm trying to understand and go, okay, no, but that doesn't make sense to me because we haven't this. And for Damon, he just gets swept up and led through the story. And he really, I mean, we had a great time breaking this story, but, you know, we had two different styles that I think end up complementing each other, but it's not without a little bit of conflict in the room. And just to back up, the biggest struggle first and foremost was, what is the story and is there enough story? And, the first few days of any new episode when you're breaking story, it's just sheer terror because it can be anything at that point, especially on a show like this where you're not, okay, we have a murder to solve or we have a bad guy to chase down. It is, it could be anything. And so how do you wrap your arms around that and bring it into a relatable story that fits into 52 minutes. But it was a lot of fun, and I feel very, very connected and proud of the story that we came up with.
Is it harder to break a story on a character-centric episode, or is it harder to do ones that involve many characters?
Every episode is its own beast, so it's impossible, I think, to compare one to the other. When you've got multiple characters, it depends upon what your style is. Some people like to break by character if you're doing several storylines in an episode, and then you start weaving them in. Some people like to just start from the beginning and move their way through the story and decide what the characters are doing as they go. Yeah, each one of these episodes, I felt like the world was going to end because they were very, very difficult. But the harder they are, the more satisfying they are when you finally break through and you go, oh, now I know what the episode is. And that's a thrill when you get to that point. But you never think you're going to reach there when you're at the beginning. You're like, this, that's it. We've forgotten how to tell stories. We've forgotten how to write. It's over. It's done. And then you sit in a room for days and days and days and days. And then suddenly, you know, just by sheer will, you figure it out.
And figure it out, you have. I mean, that episode for me was just so powerful, and how you were saying how really it's supposed to envelop the audience in grief. I think that it was incredibly powerful. When people have asked me who haven't watched The Leftovers and they ask me, you know, what is it about? And I also tell them, I said, it's very different of a show because I don't know who I'm rooting for yet. Like, I don't know who is my buddy in the show. I said, there's no Hurley, unless you call it the ping pong boys. I'm like, there's no simple minded person who is the jolly person for you. You know, you're really realizing that everyone is going through this grief in different ways. And it was beautiful and sad to see Nora for an entire episode. And I love that it was guest and it all revolved around her identity. And I wanted to ask you, how important was her identity to herself?
Well, I would say very important because it cost her everything to have that identity. It came at an extraordinary price. So what Nora Durst meant post-departure, cost Nora everything. So I think she wasn't, I don't know that she was ready to part with it because it came at such a high price.
Is that why she kept her name at the divorce court? She wasn't ready to get rid of that?
Well, she knew who she was pre-departure in the way that any of us can know who we are. And then her identity was radically changed without her consent. And the idea of moving past that and redefining herself, going away from Nora Durst, widow of three, it's just too devastating. It's too big. It's being Nora Durst is a battle scar. Every day she survives through the reality of being Nora Durst. And again, it's something of extreme value because it cost her everything. So it's not a disposable thing. And when she was in that divorce court, I don't believe that, she was in a place where she was capable of imagining what it would mean to be somebody other than Nora Durst.
And I actually like how you keep referring to it as Nora Durst. I think that's an extremely important distinction. With that said, one of the things that I really loved early in the show was when Nora was in the cafe and she just like pushed the coffee cup off of the table. Obviously that was intentional. Is that just testing people or is that like, you know, is that just something that she
or is that
just felt
her
like
being
doing?
A little cray cray?
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because that's one of the things. There are many things on the show that we would just prefer people to interpret it as they will for themselves because for the writers, we those sorts of things mean something different for each of us. Specifically, the mug. On my first day on the show, I had come prepared with all my little ideas that I was going to pitch to try to impress and be the A student. And one of them was when I thought about Nora Durst, I just fixated on this idea of her knocking shit over, of being in the grocery store and just knocking over a jar of tomato sauce. And because she could, because the universe stopped playing by the rules that as we understood them. So why should she play by any of the rules of decorum and civility? Because it's now a free-for-all. And that's what it meant for me. And when I pitched the idea of Nora knocking over to Damon, he came at it in a completely different way. and it meant something else to him entirely. And I believe that it meant something else entirely to Carrie Coon, who is extraordinary, by the way.
Yes.
I mean, just amazing. So when we talked to HBO, when they read it in the script, it meant something else to them. And, you know, they weren't quite able to articulate what it meant to them, but they understood it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So I think there are a lot of moments in the show that have resonance that belong to the individual who is witnessing to it. And you can't say, you know, this is what this means, because it's a very personal show when you watch it, I think.
I want to let you know what it meant to me. Is that okay?
Okay, good.
Have you seen that YouTube video, Honey Badger Don't Care?
Oh my God, yes. Honey Badger don't give a shit.
Yes, that's what I said when she pushed it over. Blake was like, what was that? And that's exactly what I said. I said, Honey Badger don't care. Like, Honey Badger don't give a shit.
That is not an exaggeration, Kath. That really happened. Honey Badger don't give a shit.
Yep, that's what I said. I was like, that's who Nora is. Nora's Honey Badger. Like, she's just going to do what she wants.
That is genius. Nora is absolutely the honey badger.
Take that to the room next time. Tell everybody, all right, this is her spirit animal. That's what it can be.
I'm writing it down right now. Nora equals honey badger.
Yeah. WWHBD. What would honey badger do?
Next episode, Nora's just going to wrestle a bunch of cobras, get beaten, and sleep it off.
getting back to guest. God, that was brilliant, okay. Mary. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That's why we're married. Getting back to guest, I noticed when she was, you know, obviously she had the gunshot scene, and she hired Angel to come and shoot her, and then she and she was in New York, and then she had that grenade, and I am convinced that she didn't believe. She didn't care if it was real or fake. If she felt it or not, it didn't matter. She was just going to throw the grenade down, and that was that. And, you know, and when you're talking about someone getting back to Angel shooting her, that's someone who's never shot a gun before. And Nora's asking her to hit a very specific spot. She's got Slayer playing of all these things, which was wicked cool. Excellent job, by the way. In other words, is living okay for her, or does she not care if she dies either? Is that like walking that tightrope?
Again, I would say that her motive for hiring Angel is really something that the viewer should decide. I think I wouldn't say she has a death wish. I wouldn't say the biggest thing that happened in her life was something that wasn't decided by her, that she didn't have control over it. So perhaps these incidents that you've pointed out are moments where she might be seeking to connect again with whatever power that was that made that decision. And so it's almost, I hesitate to say it, but it's almost religious, right? That, she's reaching out, and saying, if there's somebody there that's actually flipping the coin and calling it, let's see what you do in this moment.
It reminded me of Kristen Stewart as Bella in Twilight in the New Moon movie.
Don't embarrass us.
I'm not trying. I'm a fan of everything. But when she's like, she's doing reckless things because it like somehow she like thinks of Edward, and Nora is so much cooler than Bella. But it reminded
me of
like.
It's not even close. What are you talking
about?
Not even
close. I know. And probably the Leftovers fandom's going to hate me right now, but I really did. It was just Bella's character used to do all these things to put herself in danger because it like made her walk that tightrope of, am I here? Am I there? Can I connect somehow? But that's what it reminded me of, except I said Nora's much cooler than Bella. So
if that's what it means to you, then I'm glad, although I would, there's something about being an adolescent and not understanding what death means. And certainly when you're fooling around with a vampire, the idea of death doesn't exist, right? So I would say Nora is in a very different emotional and mental space than a teenager who literally believes she can live forever because she's effing a vampire. So yeah. But if that's a connection that you made that resonated, then good.
I wouldn't say resonated. I would say that I made that statement to make Blake laugh halfway through. I started to sing the Twilight song that plays in that scene, and he was like, "Are you kidding me? Are you seriously singing Twilight?"
Kath, I'm literally going to apologize for my wife, for our listeners, for this podcast, for comparing your masterpiece to Twilight. I respect that franchise. I truly do. I actually enjoyed it. But you guys are writing a masterpiece, and
well,
I don't care what anybody says.
Those books meant a lot to a lot of people. So
yep.
Who are we to say what's a masterpiece? Except
well,
you.
I can say it for you. It's okay.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it.
So as we were talking about Bella and Edward having a nice time fraternizing, for lack of a better word. Let's talk about the situation between Nora and Kevin. Mm. Why is their relationship so popular with fans, and why does it seem to be so relatable?
Besides the fact that he's not a shiny vampire.
Oh. He's covered in tattoos, and he looks great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, right. The first thing is just look at them. They're two gorgeous individuals. And I think that it's because one of the few clear examples of something that's hopeful in the show, that here is an opportunity for moving on, for letting go of the grief just a little bit. But I also think that these two people can identify each other's damage and are so accepting of it. And one of the things that we enjoyed so much whenever writing Nora and Kevin scenes, and there was only ever one per episode, and so it was highly valuable to us, was their honesty. That when you're on a first date or when you're first meeting a person, you're projecting so many things that aren't necessarily truthful. It's your heightened best version of yourself, or their interests suddenly become your interests too. And then slowly over time, when you gain trust in one another, is when you actually show who you are and you're honest. And for Kevin and Nora, they just start from an incredibly honest, truthful place. I mean, she says my husband cheated on me. He says I cheated on my wife, and that just sets the tone for the relationship moving forward. And I don't know. And also, you want Nora in Kevin's life. I think Nora would be good for Kevin because Nora doesn't take any shit, and Kevin is trying as best as he can, but is lost, and I think needs a partner and needs somebody to say it's going to be okay. I think they're fantastic. I think they have just tremendous chemistry, and I'm rooting for them. Definitely.
I agree. I am right there with you. But I have a question about someone who I don't know if I should be rooting for. I don't know if we should be rooting for Wayne in this show, because I'm right there with you. I'm loving Nora and Kevin, and Wayne is throwing me for a loop.
Well, I guess Wayne depends on how you see him. And whether you see what he's doing as a service or as an exploitation, so it's all dependent on the beholder, I think, there's many different ways of looking at Wayne, and I don't want to take that from the viewer.
I like it. We had long discussion in the last episode about his brown underwear and how I don't know where your costume people found men's brown underwear, because it almost made him look naked when he was down in that tunnel and he was, you know, like kind of failing at life a little bit. He looks a little sick, but I was just like, where did they find brown underwear? I never have seen a guy wear brown underwear. Like, girls have underwear in every color. He had brown underwear.
Our wardrobe department was tremendous, and I got to tell you, you don't realize how hard it is to find white clothing until you actually go looking for it. And they scoured almost the entire state of New York and probably bought every item of white clothing that they had, and then they had to go and age it and rough it up a little bit. It couldn't look crisp and clean because that's not the GR way. So I believe that after going through that, if they wanted to find brown underwear, they knew exactly where to find it.
In light of Wayne, Norris seems to be cured. Is that something that's going to last, or is that something that is like a placebo?
A Band-Aid.
A Band-Aid. Yeah, that's a good one. Band-Aid. I like that better.
I think a Band-Aid is an apt way of describing it. But I think whether or not she is quote unquote cured is up to Nora.
I
if I can just be cryptic.
Yeah, no, that's great. I love that, because you're leaving it to us to decide. And I think that's phenomenal.
You shouldn't leave anything up to me. I'm comparing things to Honey Badger in Twilight, so don't leave it to me, Kath.
These are important cultural touchstones, so I totally get it.
Speaking of that, too, we actually heard there was an interesting story behind Carrie Coon sipping the martini at the end of that scene with the guy who played Patrick Johansson at the bar. Could you tell us about that story?
Yeah, I wouldn't so much say that it's a story, except that it speaks to the relationship that the director, Carl Franklin, had with his actors, which he just engendered a lot of trust in them, because he started off as an actor himself. And, and on the page, that scene ended with her screaming at Johansson, and Carl just at that point had the kind of relationship with Carrie where he just left the cameras rolling and let her do her thing. I can't speak to whether he had the idea of go back and sip the martini, but I just know that on one particular take, on that take, he just let the cameras continue going and she just continued on being Nora. I mean, she just embodied Nora in such a fantastic way that you go, yes, exactly, that's what Nora would do. It's just, she doesn't run away from it. She's like, okay, yes, I just screamed at a man in public in the bar, and I'm not going to run off. I'm going to sit here and finish my fucking martini.
Honey Badger, so, that's what it is.
Honey Badger, don't
honey
give
badger.
A That's an apt description, sweetheart. I'm really proud
Guys,
of you.
Guys, Blake, you make fun of me, but let me tell you, I'm onto something. Nora is Honey Badger.
Mary deserves a writing credit. Please ask Damon for that.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness. So I was wondering, how do you want fans to feel after they've watched an episode of this series? As I told you before, I still don't know who I'm rooting for. I still don't know how I feel sometimes. And you as a writer, how do you want fans to feel?
The way that I felt when I was reading the book and when I read the pilot script, which is I couldn't quite shake it off. I couldn't quite shake off the experience of having read those things. And for me, we spend so much of our existence in denial of the clear truth, which is that death exists and that we do not know, we cannot say why we exist. And we fill our lives with distractions and do well, the majority of us, myself especially included, do whatever we can to distract ourselves from thinking about those things, because when I think about them, I just get consumed by panic and fear, and they are the hardest things to look at. And so I avoid them, and I feel that our show looks at them and forces the viewer to look at them. And by doing so, you get more connected to the human condition and to the truth of what it is to be alive and have consciousness. And so it's really difficult, hard stuff, and certainly is a challenge and asks a lot from the viewer. But I think valuable, because there's little point in, because when the end does come and you've avoided the reality of it your entire life, I feel sorry for you, because it's I don't know how you can confront it, how you can face it without looking at it in the eye a little bit, at least on the way there. So that sounded really that sounded a little self-important, and anyways, that's what the show means for has meant to me, and it's very challenging, it's very difficult, it's very scary, but I think it matters. And so I think if it can just for an hour out of the week that of people's lives, if they can just sit and confront those things, that's what I hope the show does, is shows a little truth, or makes people confront some truth.
All right, Kath. So lastly, our last question is, what can you tease about the next episode you've written that's coming up next Sunday?
Episode 9, The Garveys at Their Best. I can tell you that it is the next episode. It is the episode before the finale.
This is good stuff.
Yeah,
good stuff.
there will be much like this week's episode provided some answers. There are answers provided in 109, and I did already tweet this, so it's not a scoop. I apologize, but Christopher Eccleston dances. We'll see a little bit of him dancing. So there's the great big spoiler.
Oh, I love it. the memes that are going to be made, or not GIFs. That's what it is. GIFs or GIFs.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Yes. I'm hoping for one.
I was going to say, I actually saw that tweet and I was like, oh no, come on. You're supposed to scoop me on that one.
Sorry.
Jeez, come on. No, that's okay.
It's just so great. I can't, like, I'm so excited for, for Sunday to come around.
Oh, now I am. I'm excited to see if it's a jig or a tap dance. I don't even know.
I get to see Doctor Who dance. I mean, come on.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Oh, well, Kath, thank you so much once again for taking the time to chat with us here on the Living Reminders. It was an absolute treat, and I hope maybe we can convince you to come back on again later at some point.
Oh, I would love it. Thank you, guys. I had a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Kath, thank you for taking the time. I know you're an extremely busy woman. You're helping out a podcast, and trust me, the diehard fans of your show are listening to us and other podcasts. And they appreciate the time that you're taking as much as we do. So again, thank you so much.
Well, thanks very much, you guys. And I will keep an ear out for your podcast. Look forward to it.
Wow. What do you think, Blake?
That was actually awesome. I love how she felt so deeply about the pilot and the information that was on there. She got all emotional with Damon Lindelof, and it was really exciting to hear that she actually cares about this material just as much as we do.
And even more so, I think a lot of people wonder, what is the point of The Leftovers? Mm. And I think Kath really hit it on the head for what she hopes it is. And I'm not going to lie, I'm going to start watching these shows in a totally different light.
Maybe you shouldn't compare it to Twilight anymore.
Maybe I shouldn't compare it to Aliens either. My goodness.
I think it might be just a little bit more deep than that.
Yeah, Kath opened my eyes, man.
Just a tad.
Maybe we'll have to have her on again.
I think we probably should. I'm not going to lie.
Nice. Well, we not only talked to Kath this week, but we heard from a ton of you. We had some great listener feedback. Let's get into it. We had some emails this week from Lily. She said, you guys were discussing Nora hiring the hooker to shoot her. I was thinking when I watched that scene that it was like a flatliners kind of thing.
Oh, great movie. Good job. There's no movie better than a movie with Kevin Bacon, Kiefer Sutherland, and Julia Roberts in it.
Hey, that's like a dynamite trio. Lily says, to me, it was like her on her own near-death experience. Maybe she thought if she had some way of being close to dying, it would somehow bring her closer to her family or communicate with them in whatever place they had moved on to. Like a portal for communication. About the Reverend and Kevin's wife bumping into each other in the backyard when he was digging up the jar of money, and they were both like, don't anybody. Maybe Lori kept watching him while he dug up the money, and then Lori gives Patty the heads up. So they keep an eye on him, and that's how they know he might be able to save the church. And they set up that rock-throwing incident, knowing he will stop, and he gets whacked in the head, causing him to miss getting the money to the bank on time.
Great idea. I think that is totally plausible.
Oh, yeah, and I don't know. Lori's a female, and if you any females listening, we're snoops.
Yeah.
So totally when he left or when he did any of that stuff, she would have looked in there and... Oh, I totally would have known what was going on.
Wim emails us and he says, what if the 2% did not disappear at all? What if the world we see in the show is a carbon copy of the real world? What if all the best bits remained in the original version of reality and only the leftovers ended up being in this alternate reality? So the rapture didn't remove 2% of the people, but kept them where they were and only moved the rest somewhere else. I know it's maybe a bit out there, but so is the whole show. Smiley face.
Wim. My mind, it's blown. Cool idea, Wim.
Amy emails us, while everyone else Googled the May 1972 National Geographic, I immediately Googled May 1972 events, and she found that May 10th was known as the bloodiest day in Vietnam War, and it included a series of dogfights.
Ew.
Which means that, you know, dogfights are... planes fighting in the air. And
oh, I felt like
not like literally
fight,
dog
like
fights.
Bulls. Okay,
but she's saying that she's making the connection to all the crazy dog connections in the show, and then she follows it up with saying, throughout the world in May, there were multiple airplane hijackings, one involving Pennsylvania, a bombing at the Pentagon, and a terrorist attack on an airport, which gives us, you know, highlights of 9/11 similarities, the event that changed our lives. She concludes by saying, since the first or second episode, I had a feeling that Kevin was clairvoyant in some way. As the season has gone along, I've become more and more convinced of this, as well as his daughter having this kind of trait. After this Kevin Sr. episode, I'm even more convinced there is something that these three Garbys have. Clairvoyant may not be the best word, but I believe that they see glimpses of things happening or that they will happen via dreams, visions, and or voices. Maybe all the pills Kevin was taking skewed his ability to understand them. And now he will be able to access this knowledge better. Maybe they can see or hear an alternate universe. She heard some cool string theory ideas that was actually on our podcast recently from one of our listeners. And she says, so maybe they can communicate with another dimension.
I think they're going to start talking to Haley Joel Osment.
I see dead people.
That's right. Ooh, I like that theory.
Me too. I think that's a good one. I'm totally of the belief that Kevin was taking these drugs and it was skewing his mental awareness, and that somehow, some way, he needs to be off them to get in touch with whomever is trying to be in touch with them, either via Kevin Sr. or now actually even Dean, because we saw Dean was talking to these spirits. Well, at least that's what I believe that he was doing. I don't think he was speaking to Patty.
Dean freaks me out.
Dean the dog killer, he's got a bad attitude.
Ooh.
Especially with that lipper in his mouth all day.
Stop it. Just spit it out. It's bad for you. Anita wrote an email saying, while watching the episode, I genuinely thought that Patty had planned the whole thing, especially when she confessed to stoning Gladys, further proof that she's insane. But now I don't think that's the case. I think it may have been in her plans, but took advantage of the situation when she saw Kevin's insecurity about the kidnapping. She thought, this might be my chance, and started dancing around his thoughts. I don't believe she expected Kevin to resist at the end while accepting the consequence of his action and calling her bullshit, therefore taking the step to play martyr as well. Not really sad to see her die, but she was a great antagonist. Let's see how Lori does. But if she feels, she won't do well.
Chiquita emails us saying, Kevin's dreams throughout the season were probably reality mixed with visions. I think it's an obvious sign of things to come. Since he doesn't want to accept it, it's happening in a state of mind where it feels like a dream. When he flushed his pills, I was happy. I thought the pills were making him crazy, but was actually suppressing his imagination and was making him, quote unquote, sleep. Once he stopped taking them, and by Dean's timeline of 2 weeks, his system was probably clear of the drugs, and he was awake and is now able to recall terrible things he's doing. He is now awake, quote unquote, but because before, he had no idea what his nights consisted of. He would just jolt out of his sleep and wonder what the hell he was doing on the floor shirtless. From episode 2, where he dreamt he was being led into the woods by Amy, where Dean was with a gun, to the dream with Tommy and Dean in the mailbox, he was seeing things, but he didn't understand what they meant. Remember when I emailed you guys and said that after Gladys was stoned, Kevin awoke and I thought he dreamt it? Maybe he was actually there. And Dean didn't tell him because Dean's a dick.
I hate Dean. I'm right there with you.
God, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he was there.
What? What?
I have a great sudden theory of the week.
Give it to us right now.
Sudden theory of the week. You ready?
Yes.
Kevin was the one throwing the rocks. And he doesn't even know. And he hates the GR.
But Patty said she killed Gladys.
Yeah, No. She spoke to Gladys about it. She said that she was okay with it. She didn't say, yeah, I threw those rocks. Oh, my God.
You think Kevin stoned Gladys?
Kevin stoned Gladys. He was there.
I can't.
I literally just blew my own mind.
All right. Can we move on to Mike? Because I'm like so grossed out.
Yes.
I'm still traumatized by that stoning scene. Mike wrote in 2 episodes I have found so far, Gladys and 2 boats, the stoplight changed directly from going green to red without an amber light. I like that you called it amber, Mike.
Not
because
yellow.
I would call it yellow.
Me too.
In both instances, Matt was in the car. In 2 boats, he was driving to the casino and the 3 pigeons were on top of the light. In Gladys, it occurred just before Matt gave his Thomas speech to Kevin.
Mm-hmm.
What does this mean? Are the lights coming from the same source as the voices? Matt and the chief clearly have a bond, and the chief said that Matt deserved the $20,000. Is there another force at work? If there's more than one force at work, are they competing like good and bad forces? What do these signs mean? Both occur when Matt is in the car. Are they signs meant for him, or is it an aura that he's projecting that is causing the lights to go wonky? I don't know what to think other than that there is more than meets the eye going on in Mapleton. Here's my idea, Mike. The sudden departure happened while Matt was in a car, and someone did not stop.
Oh, that's very good.
So I'm wondering if things that went wrong in your life while a sudden departure happened haunt you.
Wow, that's excellent.
There's my sudden theory, and it kicks your sudden theory's ass.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, maybe it does.
I know.
Maybe it does.
We got some love on Twitter.
I don't know. If my sudden theory comes true, and I got a feeling it's going to, I would have Jill in the GR and Kevin throwing these stones. It would be unbelievable. Just give me that.
Okay. It would be great.
All right, let's get to Twitter.
Twitter loves. We had one from Froze Wine Sorbet.
Ooh.
Frozen Wine Sorbet? Can you please send us some? That is your name? Frozen Wine Sorbet? Yes, please. She thinks that Kevin Garvey was having an affair with Amy's mom. Who poofed.
That's a good idea.
And maybe that's why Amy hasn't had a home.
And that's why she's there at that house.
And that's why she's been haunting him.
Oh, is that another Southern theory?
It's part of my original. Frozen wine sorbet. Awesome idea.
They actually came back with another tweet. They said that when the judge departed during that judge that Matt was like getting all the information about, the bribe money that was in the car, which hit Matt's car in the pilot episode, Police Chief Kevin Sr. found it and gave it to Matt.
Oh, I can see that.
So that's why he has that 20 grand, is because it's the bribe money that the judge was using.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I like that idea.
That is good.
And that's probably why Matt wouldn't take it either, because it was dirty money. Wine God tweeted in, "The Leftovers is so fucking depressing, and goddamn, I love this show."
Wine God needs another glass of wine, because I don't think it's getting any happier.
Maybe Frozen Wine Sorbet and Wine God should get together.
They should.
That'd be a great idea.
That'd be a delicious. Alex SK said, "I thought the last season Lost was hot garbage, but Lindelof gave some legit answers tonight."
Yes, he did. And I got a feeling.
Hot garbage. What does that mean?
It's just, you know, hot garbage. Like, it just, he thought it sucked.
Oh.
Hot garbage.
Oh. Okay.
Because okay. All right. But I'm going to say this. I challenge anybody, especially you, Alex SK, to tell me what mysteries and what answers were left out and were not answered in Lost.
Joe Garfine tweets, "What the F? The last scene in tonight's episode of The Leftovers. We are immersed in deep, dark, disturbing territory here. Phenomenal."
I feel like everybody has had that same kind of attitude about this episode and like the dark tone of the show. People are kind of like, ugh, but then they love it. Harry Sucka. God, I love that name. Harry Sucka.
I don't like that.
Ugh. Realizing what the people in the white are doing with those clothes on The Leftovers. I love the pit in my stomach from the feeling in this show. You know, the clothes that they were putting in the church?
Oh, stop it.
Getting all the potentially the loved
ready for
ones.
The fake people. Oh. Ew.
Oh, I got a great sudden theory about that, too, by
Aaron
the way.
Aaron M. Villalobos says, okay, I'm guessing. Is he blacking out or does all of this stuff because he's crazy like his dad? So Aaron's wondering if, you know, Kevin's doing this stuff for real or if he's just flipping crazy. We don't know. Shavis also tweeted, Jill is not guilty remnant. I think she wants something familiar. What does Kevin do from here? Does he spread word about Patty?
No way. There's no way he does. And I think Jill's going straight to the GI, by the way. She thinks her life sucks. She's got nothing like holding her down. And the only thing that she does like is her mom. And she may not understand the fact that you're not supposed to have a familiar relationship in the GI, but that's why she's going to stick there.
She's going to like the pancakes because she likes breakfast. Like, she usually likes cereal. I think when they switch her over to the gruel diet, she might leave. She'll miss her cereal. Jason Martin's tweets, well, The Leftovers, no one but Michelle McLaren could have directed that emotional roller coaster. Truly incredible and heartbreaking.
I know. That musical montage in the beginning was beautiful. Loved all the emotion and the character development. Just because Michelle McLaren.
Pretty Fly for a White Girl tweets, who else thought Jill was going to stab the dog? Just me? No, I was right there with you, Pretty Fly for a White Girl.
I think everybody else was,
totally
too.
I thought she was totally going
to
stab him.
Oh.
Sandra Campbell says, Dean's a guardian devil who always happens to be around when Kevin's evil alter ego wants to come out and play. And during the podcast, does Blake's accent slip out or is that a put on?
No, that is an absolutely real thing. I swear to God, I don't put it on. That's
Blake
just how I speak.
This is where, like, Blake's from Massachusetts, so that's how people speak in Massachusetts. And I'm sorry if you can't understand them sometimes.
So, you know what? There was actually a quick story. When we were in Pittsburgh one time, and I was shopping for clothes, and one of the guys in like JCPenney was trying to help me out, and he's like, "Sir, you know, how can I help you? Yada yada." I go through the whole thing, the whole deal with him, buy all the clothes, and at the end of my transaction, he says, "Oh, so where are you from in Ireland?" And I was like,
"Ireland,
bro, I'm from America. What are you talking about? I live in Massachusetts." And he goes, "Oh, okay. Well, where do your family come from in Ireland?" I'm like, "No, you're not getting it. My family's been here for years. Trust me. I'm not from Ireland, bro." That's
so
a true
Blake's
story.
Accent is real.
That's 100% real. And it does. The more that I drink, the worse that it gets. And the more that excited that I get, the worse that it gets. So I'm sorry. That's how it works out.
Pamela Andrews tweets, the guilty remnant may wear white, but they are some sadistic sons of bitches.
Damn right, man. Killing their own people and slashing their own throats. Oof. Damn.
T TV for the win, says, I can't even handle what I just saw. I feel violated, a little brain effed, and I think I like it.
Yeah, that's what we all do. I think it's a guilty pleasure for everybody. Ooh, guilty pleasure, guilty remnant. Coincidence? I think not.
Caroline Stiers, not to be dramatic, but The Leftovers is ruining my life.
Yours and mine both.
Oh my goodness. Nefer Segal says, true love is telling someone you're fucked in the head and they casually say, join the club and mean it.
Oh, that's right. I love Nora and Kevin. They're so good.
Ship that. WAP Genius 51 says, The Leftovers is mind effing me right now. This is like the theme of the week. Goodness. How rude for this show not to wear protection. Oh.
This was beautiful. Great tweet.
All right, what's our tweet of the week?
Tweet of the week comes from Santiago Villalba. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Villalba?
I think so.
Says, the tweet is, The Leftovers. The first 30 minutes, what the fuck is going on? The next 20 minutes, oh, I see. The last 10 minutes, what the fuck is going on?
That's yes,
awesome.
I echo all of that.
That's exactly how we felt. So congratulations, Santiago Villalba, for the tweet of the week.
Yay, congratulations.
All right, kid, what do you say we get into the voicemails real quick?
What's up, Marion Blake? This is Dylan from the Guilty Remnant podcast. I just want to say congratulations to us on getting The Leftovers renewed for a second season. I think that there's no argument that is definitely due to our The Leftovers hashtag that we got out there. And we got literally dozens of people to hashtag on Twitter Renew The Leftovers. So HBO could not say no to that. So because of our efforts and your guys' help, we were able to get our new second season. And we're going to have a job next year when The Leftovers comes back. So congrats to us. Definitely because of us. I don't think there's anything else that would have had an effect on that. And I just want to say congratulations to all of us. And you guys did a good job. All right, bye.
Very special thanks to Dylan from the Guilty Remnant podcast for calling in. Thank you so much, Dylan. As always, you guys are a class act. And yes, definitely, it is definitely as a result of our hashtag that The Leftovers has been renewed. Dozens and dozens of people definitely tweeted that out. And they know how much power we have. Thanks, Dylan, for calling in.
Hey there, Mary and Blake. What's going on? This is Sean calling from North Hollywood, California, also known as Sean Mullins 33 on Twitter. So I was calling in to say I somehow get a feeling that Patty and Dean, or bald dog killer guy, were somehow in cahoots into setting up that whole scenario with Patty being tied up and having Kevin go crazy, thinking he's crazy. Maybe he is. Who knows? But yeah, it just kind of seemed like it was all part of a big plan that Patty had. What the purpose is, hopefully, if it is the purpose, we'll find out. So keep it up, guys. Loving the show.
Sean, I love this idea. Actually, another good theory out there is that Dean is working for AtFec. A cool idea. I like it, but we'll see how it plays out.
I am really confused after the last episode. I see Kevin now very much as Jack in Lost. Big Lost fan here. I'm seeing similarities like the cabin. I'm really wondering whether the tobacco-chewing dog killer Dean is actually real now. In the beginning, I thought he wasn't real. Then I thought he was because it looked like everybody else in Mapleton can see him. But now I'm thinking that maybe he's not, and it's all in Kevin's mind. The only thing that gets me going is that Patty sees him too, refers to him as a ghost. So, and she's missing. So we are led to believe. So to answer your questions, I'm not sure that Patty planned the whole thing. I'm not sure what happened was real, only perhaps in Kevin's mind. As for Amy, I think she's just hurt feelings because Jill is just finally so desperate to place blame in other people that she made that accusation about Amy getting it on with Kevin. I cannot imagine that Amy would do that, and I can't imagine that Kevin would do it unless it was blackout Kevin. Jill, is she really GR? I think she's going to try to confront her mom because I think that is a symptom of everything that happened in the last episode, is she just really feels the need to confront her mom about this. And I think that's answered all the questions. Doing a great job with the podcast. Really enjoy it. Was really hoping to hear it the day after, because I'm so eager to hear what you hear, what you have to say. But really enjoy it and look forward to it. Thanks. This is Scott. Bye-bye.
Thanks for sticking your name in at the end there, Scott. And about Dean, wow, isn't that the $64,000 question? Is he real or is he not? And I tend to think that Lindelof is just screwing with us as viewers.
Hey, Mary and Blake, it's Shakita, a.k.a. Serena6783. First, I wanted to talk about Meg. Assuming that this show is in present time, when her mom died on October 13th, I would say maybe, like, if it took place in 2011 when everybody departed, a month before that would have been the 10-year anniversary of September 11th. So depending on how her mom died, maybe if her mom was sick, then, you know, everybody was probably focused on that while she's in the hospital watching over her mom. You know, I'm just assuming this is probably what happened. And then, you know, her mom died one day before the departure. So Meg didn't have any time to grieve. And then as soon as her mom died, 24 hours later, you know, the departure happened and, you know, it never really settled in. And I kind of know how she feels about that because my mom died last year, 1 year, like 1 week before Mother's Day. And so basically it was like, my mom was sick for a long time. I kind of knew it was coming. And then, you know, she passed away. The Mother's Day happened the next Sunday. And it was kind of like everybody kind of moved on from it. And then I didn't grieve properly. So I feel like I understand what she's going through. When your grief is hijacked, it kind of turns you cold. Me, it didn't last as long as Meg. I feel like she turned a whole bunch in her life into shit and kind of, you know, alienated herself from her family and her fiance. And, you know, that's probably why she joined the GR. She was already losing all those feelings. Those feelings were already cold inside of her. Next, I want to focus on Kevin. So I thought the pills were the thing that was clouding his mind, but I think he's just probably insane and he's blacking out. And I did a research about Cairo or Cairo. It's 4 hours away from Mapleton. Okay. So if he leaves when he drinks, so if he blacks out, he leaves, goes to Cairo. Apparently that's where all his missing white shirts are, and kind of just whatever he does there, I'm not sure. Is he hunting dogs with Dean? Is he hunting GR? I don't know what he was doing, but it was basically the trip is an all-night trip. So when he wakes up in the morning, he's probably just either remembering what he did or he's blacked out so much that he's kind of jolts him awake. I'm not sure what's going on there. It was very interesting to see all that happening.
Shakita, first, I'm sorry to hear about your mom. That's always a tough thing. I lost my mom when I was young. Secondly, yes, about Kevin, he does seem to be losing it. I don't know if it is the pills or if it isn't, but he's definitely got his problems. And I'm looking forward to seeing how it plays out.
Hey guys, my name is Saida, and I'm sending you this from Colombia. Yes, the country. I really just wanted to ask your thoughts on Lori because I'm trying really hard to understand her, but I just can't get there. Maybe it's because she's the only one from the main cast that hasn't spoken yet. I don't know, but do you think she doesn't care or is she just pretending not to care? Like checking Nora's file and just like her face when Jill got to the GR? Does Lori know Patty killed Gladys and is she really willing to sacrifice for the cause? Amy Brandman said in an interview that Lori doesn't trust Patty or not trusted. Just give me your thoughts on her. She's such a tricky character and I kind of love her. I love your podcast and think you're doing an amazing job. Oh, and if you don't understand something I said, I'm sorry. I apologize for my accent. Bye.
Wow, a call from Colombia. That's amazing. And first of all, you should never apologize for any accent. If there's anybody that should ever apologize for one, that's me, because it's super thick. Anyway, I think Lori, she does feel, and I think it's all a facade. And whether or not she trusts Patty, or she knows that, you know, Patty killed Gladys, I think that's yet to be seen. Part of me thinks that she does, but definitely Lori is all, it's all a facade. There's no way that she doesn't feel the way that Patty wants her to not feel.
Mary and Blake, this is Brian at BDF331 with a prediction based on my previous voicemail. When you look at Damon Lindelof's work on Lost, we know that when a character loses all hope, something or someone comes along to help them rediscover their faith. Lost fans that know the end of season one can identify exactly what I'm talking about. In The Leftovers' case, all hope was about to be lost for Kevin when he gets back to Mapleton and learns that Jill has likely joined the GR. However, he has a couple aces in the hole, the first one being Jill. I can't imagine the show killing off Lori, even though Patty said her own martyrdom was coming. Jill joining the GR changes everything. This will be the driving force behind Lori not going through with her own martyrdom and then leaving the GR, since she doesn't want her daughter to suffer the same fate as the rest of the GR. However, both of them are still suffering. They need something or someone to offer hope. And thus, we have our biggest ace in the hole, Tommy. I think Tommy returns to Mapleton with Christine no matter what. Perhaps Kevin gets a hold of him somehow once Kevin learns of Jill, or he returns there regardless since he no longer has to wait around for Wayne. Kevin will be in such disarray that Tommy will then wrestle with the idea of tracking down Wayne to save the family with his hug routine. Perhaps Tommy won't have to track him down all too much since Wayne will likely be looking for Tommy anyway. I like the idea of Nora overhearing Tommy and Kevin discussing Holy Wayne and wrestling with her own decision of whether to help with this plan since she was hugged by Wayne and may know his whereabouts. I can picture Kevin being skeptical of Wayne's power, which is what makes Nora's endorsement so key to the idea of Kevin getting on board with tracking down Wayne in order to save his family. Nora makes this storyline interesting, since she knows she might lose Kevin if Lori and Jill are suddenly happy again and are also reunited with Tommy. She's already lost her family once. Does she want to risk losing another family that she has a chance to be a part of currently, even if it's just Kevin? Interesting stuff either way.
Brian, as always, great stuff. I think your words speak for themselves. You put it better than I could ever put it. So I'm just going to leave it at that. Great, great stuff.
Hi, Mary and Blake. This is Clint Church from Aledo, Texas. It's not far from Fort Worth, and my wife and I watch your show or listen to your show all the time, and we're really excited about this upcoming episode, and especially this last night's crazy episode 8. I actually ordered the National Geographic, and I think Lindelof is just trying to mess with us because I think it just has a few little things in it, but who knows, maybe it has a little more nuggets in it as the show goes along. But I was reading through it, and maybe I'm just not as smart as he is, so I think that's pretty normal though. So my theory for the week that I wanted to share with y'all, and maybe see what you think about it, and I'll go quick and let y'all put it on the air, and then you can talk about it if you're interested. My theory is that Dean is very real, and that I think his real name is Neil, and that Neil, whether it's Patty's husband, Patty's friend, whoever it is, I think it's actually Dean, because Patty drops that doggy bag, the pun is intended, I believe, after confirming that Lori is ready to take over, after she tests her by letting her talk or offering to let her talk. I think that was in episode 5 or 6. But then I think Dean or Neil knows the plan for Cairo, and that was what was in the doggy bag, to kidnap Patty and to make Kevin think it was his idea. Remember that Dean was also present when Gladys was stoned, and so I think that has something there. I don't know exactly what is going on. Again, I think Lindelof is smarter than me on all this, and I'd like to hear what y'all have to think. I do think Patty's tears at the diner were tears of joy because she knew she was going to get to die soon, and that's why she wrote Neil on the bag. She was laughing and crying and excited. So that's my little theory of the week. Hope y'all are having a great day and a great week dissecting this episode. What an incredible episode. And I look forward to listening to the podcast. Thanks a lot, guys. Bye.
Clint, thanks for calling in. Yeah, Lindelof is a lot smarter than all of us. That's just no way around it. But interesting theory about Dean and Neil. Could be the same person. I think it's fantastic. I never even thought about it like that. Excellent job.
Hey, Mary and Blake. It's Sarah in Salt Lake City. My Twitter is Taboo Molly. I have a couple of thoughts on this week's episode. I don't think that Kevin's love with Amy. I think that she was just really pissed, and she said those things to the daughter. And also, what the hell? Why is Patty killing Gladys and then herself? I don't get this whole thing. Maybe you guys have some thoughts on that. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Sarah, for calling in. Yes, finally, someone who agrees with me that Kevin did not sleep with Amy. Oh, sorry, that's my son in the background. Anyway, yes, he did not sleep with Amy, and it's not going to happen. And then in terms of Patty, yeah, she killed Gladys so that people would remember the GR, and they would remember the event. And then in terms of killing herself, it's putting Kevin in that position. It's like an untenable position. He has to be able to make a decision, and that not only would he either be ruined or she would be the martyr that she wants to be for the GR, just like Gladys. So that's the reason why that happened. Sorry, my son's freaking out.
All right, everyone. Thank you so incredibly much. What, Blake?
My tweet of the, my sudden theory of the week.
Oh, you have another one?
Yes, I got another one.
Okay.
You guys are going to be blessed with three sudden theories of the week this week.
Oh my God.
The first episode.
You're just so happy because some of yours came true. You feel like you need to fill in the holes.
I have to keep going. This is phenomenal.
Okay,
all
go.
Right, my newest one. We all know, in my opinion, that Memorial Day, they are going to have the loved ones.
Can we just call them the American Girl dolls?
They're going to have the loved ones.
The emo American Girl dolls.
And they're gonna show them all up there and everything. And remember, if you in the last episode, I said that Meg's going to die, right?
Yes.
I think that Damon Lindelof is too smart to show his cards this early. He knows that everybody's going to put the two and two together and see that the loved ones are going to be used on Memorial Day. What I also think is that Meg ended up saying to Lori, I wish I could see their face when on Memorial Day. And then before she can continue, Lori slaps Meg right in the face before she can continue, right? Okay, so why is it that Lori will not be able to see Nora's face?
Because there's going to be a huge crowd.
But maybe she'll be like, she's supposed to be sticking with Nora, right? She's supposed to be haunting her the whole time. The reason why I say all of this is because something else is going to happen. It's not going to just be the loved ones. I think there's going to be some kind of...
Part two?
No, I think there's going to be some kind of like sacrifice that she's going to have to make of some sort. Some people are going to die in some way, some fashion. And there's something else is going to happen. And it's not just going to be the loved ones. Lindelof has got something up his sleeve. I know it. Because it's too early to tip the cards. Why would you do that as a showrunner?
I don't know. I don't think the way you do... I can't even keep up half the time with what's even been shown to me.
So something is going to happen outside of the loved ones. There's going to be a bigger act to play on top of the loved ones. That's my sudden theory of the week.
Oh, okay. See, and my sudden theory of the week is that things haunt you that have to do with what happened while the sudden departure happened.
I think that's a really salient thought. Oh, yeah. That was my second sudden theory, that Kevin was the one throwing the rocks and he didn't even realize it.
Okay.
That was really good. I like that one.
Yeah, me too.
Please hang up and try again.
All right, want to close out the show?
Do.
All right, let's do it.
So you can reach out to us. We have a website called thelivingreminders.com. That is also where you can get our voicemail hotline. Love to hear your voices. Love to hear your own accent. So please head on over to thelivingreminders.com.
You can call us on the hotline at 503-454-6730. And if you're into Facebook, get us at facebook.com/livingreminders.
You can find us on Twitter. Our handle is Living Reminders.
And the email machine, too. You can get us at livingreminders@gmail.com.
Don't forget, if you like this show, if you love this show, head on over to iTunes and give us a rating and write us a little review. We love to hear from you guys. It honestly makes our day. Like, Blake and I geek out when we get a new review and we're like, oh my God, they do like us. It could be 7 a.m. and that's what we do. We have like a little, what is it when you get all verklempt? You get all verklempt. That's what happens.
Get all emotional.
He'll call me at work and he'll be like, you won't believe it. Someone said they like my accent. Okay, good. So please head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We will geek out and be very excited. Don't forget, Blake and I also have two other podcasts. One is about parenting, babies and toddlers and being pregnant. It's called Parent Cast. And we also have another show that we've started to watch, and it's bleeding over into the same month as the Living Reminders, as the Leftovers right now. August, we're doing two TV podcasts. Once August leaves, there will be one show that we're doing a podcast that is on, and it's called Outlander. And that podcast is called Outlander Cast. It's about time travel, heading over to Scotland. So for you history buffs, or for you people who are going to be needing a show to watch on the weekends now that the Leftovers is ending, you might want to check out Outlander.
It's all Scottish people get drunk.
Not Boston people.
No.
Like real people from the UK with an accent.
Yeah.
That would be funny. That would be funny to have like at the Outlander cast actually just be Bostonians.
Well, that's why you got me. I just show up and like talk about it.
It would not be as sexy.
Nah, definitely not as cool. Definitely not as dirty either. And I don't wear kilts.
No.
So hey, look guys, I really want to thank Kathleen and Felter. Please send her some love on Twitter. She's got a huge Twitter presence. And I thank her, obviously, for coming on the show. And let me personally thank Ms. Lingenfelter for coming on. She was absolutely phenomenal. Gave us a lot of great insight. Thank you. You made our day, our listeners' day. Oh, you were just the best. Thank you so much.
You were, Kath. # Honey Badger.
Honey Badger don't give a shit.
Thanks again, everyone. I'm Mary.
My name is Blake.
And you've been listening to The Living Reminders.